Hello, and welcome to a roundtable discussion on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, I'm joined by guests for a lively conversation on a topic we hope you'll find interesting. In this episode, I am joined by my sister Kay, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on The Lost Fleet, Beyond the Frontier, Leviathan, which is book 5 of the Beyond the Frontier group of novels, which is series 2 of the Lost Fleet novels. There were 6 of those, 5 of these. That puts it at book 11 in the whole chain. All of this is written by Jack Campbell, which is actually the pen name for John Hemery or something like that.
That sounds right.
He's written some other stuff, according to this, again, New York Times bestselling author of, and they list the last book. So these books are doing pretty well. And where we left off in the previous one, Steadfast, they had discovered what they were referring to as the dark ships, automated AI ships that were built by the Alliance to, you know, protect the Alliance from Admiral Gary and his group.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, as the scene had been set before, AIs, of course, always go rogue.
And have the potential.
Have the potential, and that's exactly kind of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, and their stand from the start has been, you know, there are a lot of things computers do great, but they don't have a moral compass, they don't have the ethical code of humans. That's why we always have an operator there to say yay or nay to what the computer bounces out.
They don't have the gut feeling a human would have, or the ability to react to the unexpected, or kind of second-guess things, both good and bad.
Yeah.
And a lot of this novel was dealing with that fleet. It wasn't exclusively that.
True.
There was a lot of it.
Well, and there were a few times where they were trying to figure out just what parameter is this AI using or operating. For instance, they seem to have blockaded a planet, but they seem to think any ships, be they from that planet or from anyone else, are the enemy. So they seem to simply think ships are the enemy at this point.
Yeah, the ship's fine if it's in the hangar. The minute it comes out, it'd get blown to bits or something like that.
Yeah.
It's a matter of, and this is an overall theme of the books, of know thy enemy.
Yes.
And at this point, there's a lot of, well, how are these programmed? What simulation is it trying to run? What parameters is it operating under? It's easy to say, oh, it's just like Admiral Gary, it's using the old playbook, that kind of a thing. But as they learn through this, there are some key differences.
Mm-hmm.
It really wasn't thinking in terms of logistics.
Yes.
There were times those things ran out of ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time it doubled back to go help one of its fallen ships, even though there was really nothing to save there.
Yeah. Well, it didn't understand why Admiral Gary would go back to help a ship.
Mm-hmm.
It knew the pattern, but not the logic or reasoning behind the pattern.
And therefore, why the pattern didn't hold when there's no people to go save.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of things like that that I found interesting. We get some major breakthroughs with the dancers.
Yes.
In terms of how they kind of think and operate and communicate specifically. Unsurprisingly, it was Shamrock, that lieutenant, that was a key player in that.
Mm-hmm.
Got some, I don't want to call it a subplot, it was almost a side subplot, if you know what I mean, with her and Iger and some of that stuff.
There'd been a little hinting back and forth, and it actually played out.
Yeah, and it had payoff, and it was
good,
but it was one of those things that is there to show the well-roundedness of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like it was an actual subplot of the book, if you know what I mean.
Well, I had asked you at one point while we were reading these books, had you been paying attention to when the book title ship came into play within a given book, how meaningful it was within a given book? For instance, Steadfast.
Mm-hmm.
That ship seemed to come in very late in that book and be symbolic.
Well, I took its relevance to the title of that as when this Johnny in that last book was saying that it's kind of the heart and soul of the fleet.
Yeah.
You know, it has symbolic importance to the people. And that conversation I took as why we got that name for that novel versus any particular role that ship played.
Yeah. Whereas with this book, Leviathan, when the reason for the title comes out, it was, you know, I really wish I could remember which captain, which ship. Because if I was doing a better job of keeping track of which captain, which ship, I think I'd have realized a lot earlier what was inevitably going to happen in the final battle.
How so? I don't remember which captain, which ship.
Captain Tulev, Leviathan.
Got it. And he, of course, doesn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good death for him.
Oh, it was really good, and he had some good scenes about kind of the war ending. He thought that would be, I don't want to say a magic cure-all, but that that would heal something in him and make the war for him end. And what he realized was just because a peace treaty was signed didn't mean that sense of war and the world is wrong had suddenly vanished from within him.
The dichotomy of when the war officially, theoretically ended and when it actually ends for the people who fought it.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, in a lot of real wars, there's a peace treaty signed, there's some demarcation line we use in the history books as it ended at this point. But there's getting the troops out, there's the aftermath for the troops, there's the hard feelings sometimes for a generation after that.
Yeah.
I thought Tulev was well used in this book and throughout the entire series.
Yes.
Who would you cast for that role?
I don't know. And part of why I struggle is because he was the man without a planet. And there was a soberness to the character and a gravity to the character that always made him so interesting, but I think is hard to bring to the screen.
The two names that are coming to my mind, Alan Tudyk, in kind of a dramatic role, if you will, i.e. not the comedic and that kind of a thing. I think he could really bring a very interesting approach to it. He, of course, best known for, among other things, Firefly, Serenity. He was in A Knight's Tale, some other stuff.
He was great in A Knight's Tale.
Crazy talented.
Yeah.
The other one, and this is going more towards almost that haunted aspect of the man with, you know, no surviving planet, I think Reed Diamond could do an interesting job with it.
Yeah.
And it's one that, again, if they were to do this, be it a Netflix show, a TV show, whatever, getting the right actor for a couple of these roles.
Yes.
Because if they were to go in knowing, okay, we've got, I don't know, 18, 19 more novels, here's what we need each person for.
Mm-hmm.
And really, the whole thing so far is taking place over the course of a year or so.
Yes.
So the characters don't really age visibly at that point.
Yes and no.
Well,
there are some of them that the stress and the war take a toll on them. And there are occasionally we get descriptions of, I think he aged 5 years since our conversation an hour ago, trying to get that ship in gear to maneuver with the rest of the fleet.
I guess in my mind, that's a different kind of aging than the graying of hair and that sort of a thing. It's the eyes look a little more sunken. The stuff you could do with a makeup effect.
Yeah.
Okay. In other words,
not 5 years old to 25 years old.
Exactly. It's not like the Harry Potter kids that you've got to age up or something. My point being, you could have all of the screenplays done ahead of time, so you could get some really good actors, and they may only need to shoot for a week or two if you shoot their stuff and kind of piece it together.
Yeah.
Because the amount of time a lot of these people spend physically in the same room is kind of few and far between.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a couple of times here that Admiral Gary actually calls a couple of the captains that are across the, you know, leading the different divisions or whatever, into his stateroom and says, let's do a face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is doing the virtual conference room type stuff.
Yeah.
And that gives you a lot more ability to time when you would shoot certain things.
Yeah. Well, and the face-to-face, that was an interesting security concern.
Mm-hmm.
Because now that we realize we have an internal threat, we discover that the reports Gary has sent in are basically being fed to this internal enemy to give them ideas.
It couldn't have learned about our last engagement. Wait, how long since we sent the stuff to fleet headquarters would it have taken to get there, back, you know?
Yeah.
Do the math and, oh, they've had time.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting. We'd also set up in the last book, you can't trust the fleet readiness reports. They're being faked.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd seen throughout the novels, both this group and the previous, that Rion has the ability to tap into, you know, otherwise encrypted messages and get in where she shouldn't be able to get into physically.
Yes.
And that has definite payoff in this novel.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I'd say at the end, there's a conversation about Rion that is one of the best conversations, probably of the whole series.
With the turn her into the political hero?
Yes. It's kind of a, you know, we've had these 11 books where formerly Captain John Garry, now Admiral John Garry, the legendary Blackjack, has spent 11 books telling us, I'm not Blackjack, I'm not the hero, I didn't come back from the dead. And now he sees the irony of letting her become the hero of politicians.
But the whole time, he's also kind of begrudgingly admitted, I understand why they needed a symbol.
Yes.
Just why did it have to be me?
Yes. Well, and why did they have to attribute certain expressions to me, etc.?
How did the legend build? What the hell was it based on?
Yeah.
But then having seen all of that, knowing what she had done, the concept of building a legend based on her.
Yeah.
Many, you know, Charbon was saying, you know, it's based on fact. We may embellish.
Mm-hmm.
Which no doubt is exactly how the legend of Blackjack grew over the century.
Yeah.
You know, a politician willing to die for the cause.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly won a number of converts within the fleet.
Yes.
That's Johnny among them.
Yeah. Well, and having been so utterly and completely betrayed by the government, she had worked so hard to be a good member of.
Yeah. Her rationale for why she stayed, why she did what she did, and why she was willing to die to save the fleet and the Alliance made perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
I'll admit, she went over there to... They get to Unity Alternate, have this big battle, and it turns out the entire Black Fleet is there. So they're... The fleet had gotten to Unity Alternate. The entire Black Fleet was there, more than they were expecting. They were hoping they'd be able to take out the support bases, and just, therefore, the ships couldn't repair, couldn't rearm, couldn't, you know, resupply. Wasn't that way, they got ambushed. But because Rion was able to destroy the Hypernet gate in that sector, much like we'd seen in one of the early books, she knew if she timed it just right, Garry could get the fleet behind one of the two stars in the binary system and be safe. But again, the way she had been betrayed and so forth there made sense. But she got into that base in Unity Alternate on a ship with what the platoon or battalion or whatever of the Marines.
Yeah.
And it felt like it was a small enough force that they should have known whether she was on the ship or not firsthand.
Two battalions?
It was unclear to me how many Marines were there and how she could have not been escorted onto the ship with her husband to her stateroom.
The husband in the stretcher.
Yeah.
Managing to stay behind was what got me. And they never addressed, now I'm not sure how it should have been addressed or could have been addressed, the fact that her husband was basically condemned to a life in sedation and mm-hmm. unconsciousness or death because of the mental block. They delayed removing the mental block to the point that it couldn't be removed. And there was no comparison to that and what happened with the kicks that we brought back.
Yeah, I felt the kicks were not... We didn't have the payoff there, and that would have given a little bit of it. The use of their ship, the new Invincible or whatever, I thought was good, but it felt tangential.
Mm-hmm.
The explanation for why kind of that ghost effect was there made a ton of sense.
It did. It did.
And it makes me think that there's a lot more to be done with both the kicks and the Enigma, for that matter, than this series of novels did.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious if the author has plans beyond, I mean, obviously there's the Lost Stars stuff, which takes place concurrent with a lot of these events. And then there's the Genesis Fleet, which is a 3-novel set, only 2 of which have currently been published as of recording. The third one comes out in May 2019. Mm. I'm curious what the author's going to do after those.
Yeah.
Does he move forward? Does he go to other periods in time?
Well, the way this one ended felt like, dun dun dun! There's more story to tell.
I didn't feel it had that sense of to be continued. I did feel it had the sense of there's more story to tell, but I'm not sure just what yet. Mm. So yes, let's go home and deal with the aftermath, but it was a very different let's go home and deal with it than in the first series where it's let's go back and we're going to have to go do something about those aliens.
Yeah.
There's a sense of this story is done. Mm-hmm. The bigger picture still has some unresolved aspects, but there's no kind of sword of Damocles hanging over our head.
True, true.
So I thought there was a definite balance there, and ending it with the note of Gary and just Johnny, it's like, okay, let's head back. Let's get some time off. Do you think they'll survive a couple of months without us? Oh, I doubt it. There's always some mess to clean up.
Yeah.
And kind of ending on that note worked for me.
I will say one of the conversations I loved between Des Johnny and Admiral Gary was when he was saying, you know, I just want to get off this blasted ship and have some time for the two of us to be husband and wife.
And she's like, don't refer to the ship as that blasted ship.
Yes.
It's kind of, I get what you're saying, but you're crossing a line here, buddy.
Yes.
Again, I think the success or failure of a televised or movie version of this depends on the casting of those two.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be a definite give and take because that relationship, I think, was key to these novels.
Yeah.
And that's one where, as curious as I am about the Lost Stars, and I think that'll be the next ones we read, I'm not sure the tone, the style of those novels, because it's not going to have the viewpoint of Captain Gary that we've, or Admiral Gary that we've had the whole time.
Yeah.
It's not going to have the foil of Des Johnny.
Yes.
And even when we were with, in the previous book, Duelos, instead of Des Johnny on that other ship, there was still the feeling of Des Johnny there by explicitly not being there. Duelos would do something different. He'd expect Des Johnny to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was an author in the comics, writer, Devin Grayson, who did some stuff with some of the Teen Titans characters at one point. She was really good on the relationships and stuff. And she told a couple of one-shot stories that would be like Batman in Arsenal, who was Speedy, Green Arrow's sidekick.
Mm.
So you've got two people, one's a mentor, one was a former sidekick, that have very clear parallels. I mean, Roy Harper, Arsenal Speedy, is not Dick Grayson Nightwing. Batman is not Green Arrow. Yet there are very clear parallels between the two.
Yeah.
So the how do the parts fit kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And she would do a few others where you could tell a story with two characters, but really flesh out two other characters by how they weren't there.
Yeah.
And there was some of that with Duello standing in for Des Johnny
mm-hmm.
that I thought worked well. And here, getting to see the different captains of the different parts of the fleet, how they were being used, how that inner circle had formed,
mm-hmm.
and the ability for Admiral Gary to trust them to go do what needed to be done. It's like, you've got to go protect this, make sure the Marines don't get blasted to hell or whatever. We're going to go chase this down, you know, and not feeling the need to check in on them or worry too much.
Yeah.
And having nobody out of place.
Yeah. Well, they did have the one point during the big battle where people were wondering if he'd lost his Midas touch.
Where they kept missing the other fleet or whatever. And he was wondering, too.
Yeah, a bunch of firing runs with no opportunities to fire. And finally, he realized that the other fleet was dodging him to bait him into staying where they needed him.
I was almost expecting at one point that what was going to happen is Gary was going to essentially play prophet. Here's what I would do. Have the inner circle of captains counter, and he would correct, no, I'm going to do this. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
Play the other side of the board, if you will. And we got a little of that, but not exactly how I was envisioning it. And at the end of our discussion of the last novel, we talked about different ways they could have combated the Black Fleet. And I liked how it was the Black Fleet's lack of any mindset on supply line tactics and the human side of war.
Yeah.
It was just, here's combat. And that was a key aspect.
Well, and when we get a message from Admiral Block, you know, Admiral Block shows no understanding of the fleet he's commanding in terms of he's surprised or not expecting, at least, for them to shut off his communication when he's betraying them from within their own ships.
Yeah, he's he was doing so many things wrong, it wasn't even funny.
Yeah. But he's trying to barter. I know where Michael Gary is, but I'm only giving you the info if you save me.
Yeah. Well, and Jane Gary's response to that, if he wouldn't want a deal made in his name.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I want to save my brother, but no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
And it was also fun when Gary's fleet realizes we can take one of theirs out for every one of ours. We can make them pay for the victory. We cannot let them get out of this system.
Yes.
Period. We hold the line here.
Well, and eventually they realize that because of the destruction they've done and how they've done it, they've given the other fleet the impression that Unity has fallen.
Mm-hmm.
So Unity, or the equivalent of Washington, D.C., is the next likely target for this fleet.
Well, and Block had said that there's this scorched earth approach. They're going to just wipe through everything, figuring it's in enemy hands.
Yeah.
So the fact they had to stay and fight made sense. The fleet's and the captain's response to that made sense, particularly after having already lost Tulev.
Yeah.
And he was there. He was going to fight to the end. We can't dishonor him by not, you know. And it was not in a, as it would have been at the beginning of the Dauntless book, where we just rush into battle, we don't surrender, we don't know how.
Yeah.
This is, we know we don't have that option because the cost is too high.
Yes.
Not because we can't think of another option.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there was conversation about, we're at peace, why are we still fighting?
Yeah. There was a lot of kind of the cost of war.
Yeah.
In this book, and it made sense because the opposition this time, that did not compute for them.
Yeah.
You know, war is hell because it needs to be, otherwise it's too easy of an option.
Well, and discovering that part of their government was actually on their side, after all this time thinking none of the government was what they could believe in, what they trusted, and discovering that their government actually trusted them to be the final solution after, you know, creating an enemy fleet that had been intended to be the final solution.
Yeah, there were a couple of times where they're talking, okay, so we're saving the fleet from the fleet that was supposed to save them from us.
Yes.
You know, they now trust us to fight the threat they built because they didn't trust us.
Yes.
There was some fun moments there.
Yeah.
I think the fact that they could trust some of the government and Rion's sacrifice and stuff won a lot of, you know, Gary's fleet over on the, you know what, he wasn't entirely wrong about the government, you know, being something we can believe in.
Yeah.
So there was aspects there that made sense. And Rion's, you know, the people need to realize they are the government.
Yes. There was quite a bit of equivalent of Bible thumping, I'd say, on the, you know, it's not just that the people in the government could be better, it's that the voters could do a better job voting.
Yes. Well, it's easy to get into an us versus them situation in anything.
Yes.
As a software engineer, it often comes up in my work life in various companies as to, well, what are the requirements? What are we trying to do? You know, and there's always the mythical, the business, in quotes, that is providing that. Well, we're part of that business. But it puts the us versus them sort of a thing. It's, again, the us versus the government.
Yeah.
Which we're responsible for. We elected them.
Yes.
And I think it was in the last book where Gary had made the comment of, oh, well, I wasn't around for the last elections, but I still believe in the process.
Yeah.
So I thought that was good. I mean, overall, I thought we got really good payoff for the AI stuff that had been throughout, you know, the various previous books being built up. The battle with that Black Fleet, I thought, was well handled.
Mm-hmm.
The can we trust the government, can we not aspect was well done. The whole thing with Block from Dauntless to here paid off.
Yeah, surprisingly well.
Yeah, I thought the whole aspect of Rion throughout the whole thing. Her husband, her changing status, all this kind of stuff worked out. How she was able to be in the position she was in by faking out the sensors had been built up from, I think, even the first book.
Yeah.
So the author definitely played fair there, which I respect. I thought the dancers, we got definite payoff there, a sense of, okay, they are now true allies. They see us as equals of sorts.
And an explanation for why the conversation had been so cryptic and simplistic earlier.
Yes.
You talk to me in baby talk, I talk to you in baby talk.
Yeah, when it got to where they speak in almost a poetic musical phraseology, and once we understood that and could present ideas in patterns,
yes,
how they would want them, the response is, now we speak clearly. It's like, okay, you've gotten past this. It took you a while, but okay. I thought that was good. Them helping out against the AIs and why they did was good. But how they were also had circled in space through the previous book and their travels, the binary star, and how it took Siobhan a while to figure out, they circled this. Why did they do that? Yeah. They could have gone other. They did this.
When we first arrived at the binary star, and Gary went to give fleet maneuvers.
Yes, I liked how he had to pause. It's funny because I was doing a little reading on Wikipedia right before we recorded this on the Lost Fleet. And apparently one of the comments he'd gotten from some of the critics is how he repeats certain things often.
Yes.
Such as when the people first get to the star, the system picks an up and a down, port is either into the star or away from the star, starboard's the other way. This is so all the ships, regardless of how they're facing, can do maneuvers. And I almost think he's got a push a button, drop the paragraph in for that, jump space, a few other things.
Yeah.
It goes back to how when Chris Claremont was writing the X-Men, you know, Wolverine was the best he is at what he does. Storm had claustrophobia. Cyclops had an injury as a kid, so he couldn't control the I-beams. You know, certain key phrases that just epitomize the character. And here's the standard explanation for hyperspace versus jump space versus this versus that. And he was getting knocked for the repetition. But it was one of those things that he was doing it to where if you hadn't read From Dauntless Forward.
Exactly. Yes. Every book was accessible.
Or even if you had, but you'd forgotten, how does this work again? And it gave payoff for some of those things as to, now we got two stars. Which star do we use for reference?
Yeah.
I thought it made sense. Use the primary, not the secondary. Okay, that's cool. Even though they hide behind the secondary. But what was fascinating was, I think it was Iger who was telling him later, one of the people was telling him that when they had studied the logs from the base there, the base had edited out the binary star, the secondary.
Yeah.
So if you were visiting, you were none the wiser unless you looked out a window and saw the damn thing.
Yeah. That was part of how they kept it a secret, that it was in a binary star system. Going back to sensors could hide things.
Yeah. Well, and when Gary was talking to the Marines who failed to bring Rion back, he's like, you might want to be double-checking your sensor readings every once in a while. Just saying. Not knocking them, but
yeah,
learn a lesson from this, guys.
Yes.
So it was fun that a lot of things that had been set up in previous books, in some cases set up in every previous book, actually had some payoff to varying degrees.
Well, and along those lines, I'm wondering if in a future book we'll get payoff for the lights in jump space.
I expect so. I think the author's got some rationale for that. I think there's more to be done with the kicks. I think there's a lot more to be done with the enigma, particularly the privacy and the aquatic nature.
Yeah.
And it's just a question of what direction does he go in. It definitely doesn't feel like he's just tossed some stuff out there with, this'll do for now. And with ongoing serial narratives, it's rare for me to have too many in novel form. Because a lot of those sorts of things would either be like a Star Trek where they're jumping around in time and it's really based on something else. But in comics, ongoing serial narratives are commonplace, and it's easy to kind of sometimes spot, here's somebody who's planted seeds and knows where he's going. Others where they just have an instinctive, we're going to go this path.
Yeah.
And can build on what they've done before, but not with they clearly planted some seeds and built the payoff.
Yeah.
And both can be very entertaining and very good. There are others where they're just going and, crap, I got to do another story. I'll take a left turn here. Oh, geez, that wasn't a good idea. We'll go right, you know?
Yeah.
And there have been a few that were planting seeds, having payoff, and had that yanked out from under them, either editorially or because of the license holder or whatever. So to have somebody who's gone right now 11 books, each, I think, stand reasonably well on their own, mm-hmm. although there's a strong serial narrative. These are not individual episodic books.
Yeah.
Whereas, if you go to the Time Wars novels we talked about.
Yes.
Very much more episodic with a bit of a serial narrative across. To me, that was more the subplots and the increasing big bad.
Yeah.
Whereas here, each book has a beginning, middle, and end, but each arc has a very clear beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
At least in hindsight. Sometimes it's a little unclear midway through what's going on.
True.
But that's the balance of planting seeds versus blatantly telegraphing where you're going. If you're too obvious, it's like, well, I saw this coming a mile away, you know?
Yeah.
But I do think the lights in Jump Space, I guess it was, or Hyperspace, whatever.
Jump Space.
That stuff, there's more to be said. Certainly the Kicks, the Enigmas, certainly more with the Dancers. Michael Gary.
Yes.
They started with Corsair. When and where are they going to continue with that? Lost Stars deals a lot with the Syndic fleet. And then Genesis, backstory for how the whole thing got started, I guess. So I'm not sure where the author is going to go after all of those, or even where I think he should go. But I'd like to see the stuff continue. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, New York Times bestseller, so it's doing well. And I'm not surprised. These are easy reads.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they're 350 to 400 pages a piece. But I don't think at any point have we really kind of struggled to get through any of them. I would say, out of all the ones we've read so far, of this arc, the second book was my favorite. That's when we met all the aliens.
Yeah.
I thought the most happened there.
Okay.
Out of the first one, I would say probably the first arc of six, probably the first book.
I can see that.
And in both cases, it's where the most world building was happening.
Yeah.
And it was fun to explore the world and get that payoff.
It's a very interesting world.
Yeah. It's interesting and it's nuanced.
Yeah.
Because you can definitely see how the characters, they have their way of thinking. And they evolve over time to where, like, the Dasjani we meet in the first book and the one we've got here 11 books later, she even refers to how that previous Dasjani would have fought.
Yes. Yes.
You know, she's grown immensely in that year.
Yeah.
And that would, I think, be one of the challenges, if they were to do like a Netflix version of this, particularly as I was suggesting, arranging when they shot stuff to get key actors for windows of time, for those actors to track their arc well.
Yes.
But again, I would love to see this stuff televised.
So would I.
It's fun, it's entertaining, and particularly since we're always following Gary. To me, if they did televised, they've got to have a way that we can go from Gary sitting in the fleet commander's chair, looking at a screen for a Marine or somebody else, and almost kind of dive into that and suddenly we're there.
Yeah.
And then do the pull out.
Yeah.
Because if they could do that kind of a thing, in addition to basic fleet, you know, maneuvers and fighting and stuff, and find a way to show, unlike video games or like Star Wars or something, the battle happens in a fraction of a second.
Yes.
After hours of waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And then find a way to have that blip, rewind, replay, as they're kind of, oh, that's what happened.
Yeah.
There's some definite opportunities for some really cool and innovative visualizations of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to see that. It'd be a lot of fun. But yeah, this was a good read. I felt it resolved the arc well.
Yes.
And I appreciated how it positioned itself of there's more story to tell, but not locking it in, we must go this direction at the start of the next arc.
Yeah.
I mean, they could really go six ways to Sunday, which is, I think, a good opening for a new series of novels.
Yeah.
Anything else?
I think that does it.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.